a variety of aspects of quantum mechanics that are going to be important for our discussion. So just to set some notation, I remind you that the state of a system at any given time is specified by some by some vector psi that lives in the Hilbert space of the theory. I have various observables, O, which are associated with Hermitian operators. And if a state phi happens to be an eigenstate of this observable, O, then we say that this state phi has a definite value of O. Whose value is the corresponding eigenvalue lambda. So these are the sort of standard textbook postulates of quantum mechanics, right? So that's the first one that says what the basic objects are. There's a Hilbert space. There are states in the Hilbert space. There's Hermitian operators corresponding to observable quantities. The second tells you how to interpret the results of actual experiments. So eigenstates of these operators have definite values of the corresponding observable. The third postulate normally is that if this state isn't an eigenvector of O, then if you measure O, if we measure O and psi is not an eigenstate, so let's call this lambda associated with phi. So let's call this, it's not a, it's not an eigenstate of O, then I have to take the overlap of psi with any given eigenstate of O, phi, mod squared, is the probability that lambda phi is the outcome. Okay. And actually, there's a sort of 2 prime in the middle here, which isn't really a postulate because it really follows from the basic definitions. But again, this is just the very, very standard textbook presentation. The 2 prime says that that the state evolves according in time according to a Schrodinger equation. So there's some Hamiltonian that tells you how the state evolves in time. And so it evolves in time for a while until you do a measurement. And when you do a measurement, then what happens is that if you measure O, if at some time t you decide to do the measurement, then afterwards, well, you got with one of these, some of these probabilities, you got a particular outcome. And so afterwards, if you want to continue evolving the state, now you have to change what you're doing. So depending on what happened, if you measured that it was if it was measured that it was in one of these particular eigenvalues, now you start over again with the Schrodinger equation with that as your new initial condition, and you keep evolving. Okay? So that's the standard textbook way we had talked about things. Okay. So the first thing I want to spend some time talking about is cleaning this up so that we think about it more conceptually properly, because this is a horribly unsatisfying way of talking about things. Okay. for one thing, let me tell you what the final situation is. The final situation, there's actually nothing other than this postulate. That's it. And the basic kinematic statement. Okay? That's it. Everything else follows from that. There's no probabilities. There's certainly no measurement. There's certainly no, I forgot to say the bad words. So we say that after we do the measurement, the wave function collapses, and then you start over again. So you, if you want to keep evolving, you start with the new thing that the new state that you saw, the eigenstate, and you keep going. So so the first thing that we should actually deal with is that last point, okay? Because that just sounds complete. Anyone who learns this, I'm sure you've all gone through this. You learn it, and it just sounds ridiculous, okay? Who says who's doing a measurement, for example? Some smart experimentalist, my dog, some atom wandering by the apparatus. Who says who did a measurement? That's one interesting question. Another question is, why the heck is there two such incredibly different descriptions? First, the things evolve according to nice laws of physics, Schrodinger equation. The proof, some magic measurement happens. And then all of a sudden, everything changes, and we've got to start again. It just sounds wrong. It's caused an awful lot of extremely intelligent people to say some extremely stupid things. So over the years, so it really pays to understand this, to understand what's going on here properly. Let me just to get a calibration. How many people have heard the sort of standard story of decoherence and how it relates to the measurement problem? Just a show of hands. Okay, very good. So many of you are going to learn something interesting. All right. So so let's first talk about this very basic issue. Then after we get this straight, we'll go back and talk about a few more technical things that'll set us up for talking about combining quantum mechanics and relativity. Okay, so let's. There's actually a whole bunch of related questions here. One of them is this question of measurement. Another one is another very, very basic question you might ask. Why is it that the world around us doesn't, the world is quantum mechanical, so why does it look classical? Okay. Now, you might say it looks classical because when the actions are big compared to H-bar, things are big, you know, quantum effects aren't important and so on, but that's really incorrect. It's at most part of the answer. The statement, the kind of thing that many people see in books, is that if you look at the Schrodinger equation and you talk about a quite well localized wave packet, let's say you talk about something like that, then you say, aha, the center of mass of that wave packet moves around roughly according to Newton's laws. So that's how classical things occur, and the wave packet doesn't spread too fast. So that's why classical physics can arise out of quantum mechanics. Well, that's a very minimal necessary condition for classical physics to emerge out of quantum mechanics, but it doesn't explain an extremely important point. That state, the state of a very well localized wave packet, that's not the only state in the Hilbert space. There are zillions of states, like 1 over root 2, this chair there plus this chair there. That's a state, right? That's a state in the Hilbert space. The world is quantum mechanical. Why is it when I walk into the room, I don't see these insane macroscopic quantum mechanical states, which are these coherent superpositions of chair here plus chair there? Okay, it's like the famous question about Schrodinger's cat. There's the vast majority of states in the Hilbert space don't look remotely classical. Okay? So why does the world look approximately classical? So that's, why don't we see these big quantum effects when we're wandering around? The answer to all of these questions ends up being the following. That the distinction between classical and quantum is not so much between big and small. Let me give you another example of a counterexample to that big and small phenomenon. Let's say I hand you a big bucket of superfluid. It's big, it's heavy, it's macroscopic. That superfluid is doing crazy things. It's crawling up the sides of the container. It's doing all the cool quantum things the superfluid does. It's big. Okay? Just big isn't it, right? That's a very macroscopic, that's a very macroscopic quantum effect. The distinction between quantum and classical, and this is very related to the measurement problem, as we'll see, the distinction is not between big and small, it's between open and closed. Systems that are open and interact with any kind of environment, that environment can actually be an actual environment, like this chair interacts with the gas molecules in the room. Or, when we're talking about the measurement problem, the system that we're talking about interacts with the large apparatus. The important point is that we have a system that consists of a relatively small number of degrees of freedom that we're trying to study, and what matters is whether the system is open or closed, whether it's interacting with a larger environment. That environment could be an actual environment, the environment could be a macroscopic apparatus, or not. When things interact with large environments, they become classical very quickly, for a reason that we'll talk about in a second. When they don't, they can maintain incredibly interesting, very characteristically quantum behavior. The reason that bucket of superfluid is very quantum mechanical is it's very cold. It's very, very cold, and that, despite the fact that it's macroscopic, prevents its interaction with the environment sufficiently to allow these quantum effects to be visible and important. So that's really, that's the slogan. Classical quantum is open, closed, not big, small. Okay? So let's try to understand, let's try to understand now in a little bit more detail why that is. We can start with either one of the problems, either measurement or why things look classical. They're basically exactly the same thing. Which would you prefer? We can start with the why don't we start with the measurement issue, just because it's all right. So what we're going to do is not invent these. What we're going to do is go as far as we can, just assuming that things evolve in time according to Schrodinger's equation. Nothing else. Nothing new happens. Measurement isn't some magic phenomenon. Consciousness doesn't matter. Human beings don't matter. Okay. All we have to do is talk about a big Hamiltonian, and everything evolves unitarily, standard Schrodinger evolution, nothing fancy, okay? But we have to talk about the whole thing, right? We have to talk about the whole thing. So if I have a system S, some spin, okay? So the system S, you can imagine, and I have an apparatus A, then the whole Hamiltonian is a Hamiltonian for the system, a Hamiltonian for the apparatus, and some interaction Hamiltonian between them. There had better be some interaction Hamiltonian between them, because otherwise it wouldn't measure anything. Okay? So let's have something in mind. You know, I have a, it's like a Stern-Gerlach experiment. Doesn't matter. Something is going to measure the spin. So my system is a spin a half particle. It can have spin up or down. My apparatus is some apparatus with a magnet, and it's attached to some light bulbs. And if the spin is up, it's going to flash up. If the spin is down, it's going to flash down. Okay? Now, the whole point of designing this apparatus, the whole point, I mean, it's an apparatus to measure the spin. I could just be crazy and make an apparatus that just randomly flashes up or down depending on, you know, it's flipping a coin, and it doesn't care what I sent in, okay? Then that's fine. That's some apparatus. It's a crappy apparatus. It's not doing what it's supposed to do, right? So what is that apparatus supposed to do? If you've built it correctly, the point is that you've designed the interaction Hamiltonian and the Hamiltonian for the apparatus so that the following thing happens. that if I feed in, a state, so a state of the system is given by telling you the state vector in the system Hilbert space and the state vector in the apparatus Hilbert space. So let's say before the experiment starts, the apparatus is in its ground state. And the system is in, let's say, spin up. Right? So let's say this is the state vector for everything at time t equals 0. Okay. Now, the point of that interaction Hamiltonian is that this should evolve in time so that after the experiment is done, whenever that is, okay, I probably don't want to disturb the spin too much. So we can say the spin is still up. Maybe it was a Stern-Gerlach experiment, so it's moving in a different direction now or whatever. But it doesn't matter. We're only looking at the spin part. Okay, so the spin is still up. But now the apparatus should be flashing spin up. So there's some state of the apparatus that's flashing spin up. Okay? Now, the very important point here, you'll see why it's very important in a second, but the very important point, this is a big apparatus. The apparatus has order n apparatus. If it's made out of order n apparatus degrees of freedom, the size of the Hilbert space is of order, you know, at least 2 to the n apparatus, e to the n apparatus. It's exponentially large. The size of the Hilbert space is exponentially large in n apparatus. So dim apparatus is of order e to the n apparatus. Okay, it's some gigantic exponentially large number. That's going to be very, very important. And so the state in the apparatus that spin up, this is a state with a ton of things turned on, right? The apparatus is now, you know, it's flashing, it's sending zillions of photons, it's writing spin up, in big letters so the experimentalists can see, and so on, okay? So that state, that spin-up state, is a state which is excited a whole bunch of degrees of freedom in the apparatus, right? Okay. Similarly, the whole point of the apparatus is I send in down and I start with the ground state, that this is, should evolve in time to spin down. And flashing spin down. Now, once again, an absolutely critical point here is the following. As we'll see, this overlap between the states spin in the apparatus, spin up and spin down, this is exponentially small in the number of degrees of freedom in the apparatus. Is that clear why that's the case? Just think about it. You have like you have zillions of the dial moved this way or the dial moved that way. Okay, each thing there's a macroscopic number of things which are different in one state than the other. So the overlap between any two of them is some number a little smaller than 1. If even not 0, it's a little smaller than 1. Even let's say it's 0.99, okay? But I have 10 to the 30 things. So I get for the overlap, I have 0.99 to the power of 10 to the 30. Okay? It doesn't really matter what that 0.99 is. It's just any number smaller than 1. It's raised to a gigantic, exponentially large macroscopic number. And so these overlaps are just minuscule. Okay. So to use a unified language, the whole thing is going to port to talking about why things look classical. The different states of the system that we care about are leaving macroscopically different footprints, are correlated with macroscopically different footprints in this case, the apparatus, later in the environment. Okay. So the overlap between the states, even though at t equals 0, before the experiment started, there's one state for the apparatus, but very quickly, the whole point of the experiment is that it's giving us states in the apparatus whose overlap with each other is exponentially small. Okay? Yes.
So when it's not A ground, that's A there.
Yeah.
Is that before observation?
This is right before the experiment starts. Okay?
What does it mean that it's in like the spin up state before you try to observe?
No, so I'm sending in a state of the system, right? A state of the system and the apparatus. And I'm just saying that before the experiment starts, you have to tell me what the whole wave function is, right? And we haven't actually gotten to the most general case yet, but I'm saying the whole point of this apparatus is such that if you send in up, it had better tell you that it's up, and if you send in down, it better tell you that it's down, okay?
So have you observed it before to make sure it's up, and then you send it in?
Right. You might imagine that it's just actually even that doesn't matter. Even that doesn't matter. What I'm saying is that this interaction Hamiltonian should have this property that it does this. Otherwise, this is a useless apparatus.
Okay.
Now we're going to talk about what the actual initial state is and see how to interpret it. Okay.
So what is NA against the number of apparatus?
NA is like, let's say, the number of atoms in the apparatus. Okay? Just N counts for the actual individual number of degrees of freedom in the apparatus. So the size of the Hilbert space would be exponentially large in that number. If the apparatus was made out of a whole bunch of spin-a-half particles, then if there's N of those spin-a-half particles, the dimensionality of the Hilbert space, the dimensionality of the apparatus Hilbert space would be 2 to the N. Okay? Because there's two states for each one. In general, if it's made out of N things, the Hilbert space is exponentially large in N. I'm not telling you what the prefactor is in front of anything there, but it's just giving you an idea. It's a gargantuanly large Hilbert space. In gigantic Hilbert spaces, two states that in any given projection might even be very similar will very quickly become nearly orthogonal to each other for the reason that we just said, right? If in any projection they're off by 0.99, then that 0.99 can get raised to this gigantic number, and it very rapidly becomes very, very small. Okay. I haven't explained why that's important yet. I'm just pointing it out. Now we'll see why it's important. All right. So now let's talk about so the whole system the whole system at zero, in general, will be some linear combination for the system of alpha up plus beta down times the apparatus in its ground state. Okay? And now this is going to evolve in time to alpha up spin up plus beta down spin down. Okay? Now, let's say I want to work out the expectation value of anything to do with the spin. Either the spin itself, the square of the spin, it doesn't matter, okay? All that matters is that the operator is only a function of the spin variables. In other words, So I take psi, and I take its expectation value, but this operator only depends on S. Psi. Okay? Let's see what that expectation value looks like at two different times. First at t equals zero, and then after the measurement. Okay? On the one hand, at t equals zero, psi O psi is equal to, well, this is A ground alpha you know, up alpha star plus down beta star OS alpha up plus beta down a graph. Well, no surprise, this is just equal to up alpha star plus down beta star OS alpha up plus beta down. Because a ground is equal to 1. Okay? The state and the ground state in the apparatus Hilbert space, normalized state, norm 1. Okay, that's not very, very surprising. Okay, so this is just saying that the expectation value is just what you compute from this funny quantum mechanical state. Okay? In particular, it's equal to alpha mod squared up OS up plus beta mod squared down OS down. But it has these cross terms, alpha star beta up OS down plus the Hermitian conjugate of that. Okay? So that's what the expectation value is before the experiment. What is it after the measurement? Or sorry, what is it after the spin has interacted with the apparatus? Okay? Well, it's almost exactly the same, except now I have OS. On this side, I have alpha up, but now it's flashing up, plus beta down, flashing down. And on the other side, I have flashing up, up alpha star, plus flashing down, down beta star. But now this is rather different, because this is equal to, well, there's this term, alpha mod squared times the overlap of flashing up is 1, that's the same state. So I have the overlap of up OS with up plus beta mod squared, the overlap of down OS with down. But now my cross terms, which here before had coefficient 1, now my cross terms are alpha star beta times, indeed, something that looks like up OS down. But now the thing that it multiplies is the overlap of flashing up and flashing down in the apparatus, plus Hermitian conjugate. And as we just said, this thing is exponentially small. It's e to the negative 10 to the 30 for a macroscopic apparatus. Not even 10 to the minus 30, right? E to the negative 10 to the 30. So ridiculously minuscule number. Okay. So it makes sense to just approximate it by 0. So this was the expectation value before the experiment, but after the interaction has happened, the expectation value now just has alpha mod squared up OS up plus beta mod squared down OS down. So note what has happened. If I'm just looking at the system, right? If I'm just measuring things to do with the system, then after this interaction has happened with the apparatus, now any question I ask the system, any question at all, it's as if with some classical probability alpha mod squared, it was in the state up, and with probability beta mod squared, it was in the state down. So any question I ask afterwards is just the weighted sum exactly the same way you would do if this was a completely classical probability, right? If I told you, I'm handing you a coin with spin up or I'm handing you a coin with spin down. I'm sorry, I don't know. There's a 50% chance that it's up and 50% chance that it's down. Then any question you ask about that coin later, all you got to do is take with a 50% chance it's up and then ask anything that would be a consequence of up and add it to a 50% down and any consequence if it was down from there. Okay. And furthermore, it's clear that if this state continues to evolve in time and you do another measurement on it, then it's just exactly the same thing is going to keep happening again and again. So we see that what looks like here, the expectation values have these cross terms. Okay? Here it knows that this is this interesting pure state, this combination of up and down. Okay? But afterwards, the expectation value that I get looks like it's with some probability alpha mod squared it's up and some probability beta mod squared it's down. We didn't have to put in anything about some new magic thing that happens when measurement occurs. Okay? It's just an automatic consequence of the interaction of a small system with a large apparatus. Provided that what the questions we're interested in are just questions about the system. If we wanted to keep track of what every single one of those 10 to the 30 atoms in the apparatus is doing, then we would see something different. Okay? If we are keeping track of every single one of those things too, we would be able to really tell the difference between, we would see that it's a one big pure state again. But it's precisely because we're choosing to ignore what's going on in the apparatus and just ask questions about the system that it looks like effectively, I start with this pure quantum state, and after the interaction with some, after the interaction with the standard probabilities that we talked about, I measure one spin or I measure another spin. Yes?
Did you say that the last product?
Yes.
Small?
Yes, yes.
How do you know it's real? You have order regression.
It doesn't matter if it's real. Its magnitude is absolutely minuscule.
Yeah, so the norm of the.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. The norm is absolutely minuscule.
Yeah.
Yes?
If you design your observation thing, it's like some kind of. A system like some single particle that isn't going to have to obey, like it's not going to get entangled with the system itself.
Right.
So you do that, and then but this thing itself doesn't behave in a particularly quantum way, so then you can observe that with your macroscopic observation, but it itself hasn't like done this collapse type thing. There's only one particle there. So if the system couples to something that doesn't behave in a particularly quantum way, and it is observed by it, then we observe that thing with macroscopic system, that isn't going to obey a quantum law to you.
Every single time you have interaction with something macroscopic, unless the interaction is very, very carefully chosen so that the system doesn't leave macroscopically different footprints in the environment, you lose coherence. Okay. So maybe I didn't quite catch the setup you had in mind, let me say this a little more generally using a slightly better language, and then we'll. Come back to. Okay, so let's introduce a language that's going to allow us to talk about these things in a just a slightly more convenient way. You guys have, how many of you have been exposed to the basic idea of a density matrix in quantum forces? Okay, well, if you haven't, it's a very simple idea. So, let's first start just talking about standard pure states in quantum mechanics. So let's say I have a state psi, which is a standard state vector in a Hilbert space, and we say that the expectation value of some operator O is psi O psi. Well, we can also write this in a different way by introducing a matrix or an operator, which if the state is pure, I can just write as psi psi. Okay? The ket and the bra put together. So this is some operator. And with that operator, I can also say that the expectation value of O is the trace of O times rho. Right? Because this trace would be the sum over some complete set of states. So N, O, rho, N. Right? That's... but then this is, if I write rho as psi psi, this is sum over N, N, O, psi, psi, N. But I can move this to the other side. This is the sum over N of psi, N, N, O, psi. And the sum of N, N is just the completeness relation is 1. So this is just psi, O, psi, just like we claim. Now, if this state is a pure state, then there's some basis where rho is just 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. Okay? The basis where psi is one of the basis vectors, and then I have a bunch of other basis vectors. Then it's just 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. Okay? Now, what's convenient about talking about a density matrix is when we have a situation where we just have what you like to call standard classical-like or stochastic or any other standard classical notion of uncertainty of the sort that we just talked about a second ago. Forget about the sort of standard quantum uncertainty associated with a given state. Okay, if I have a given state, then I know, depending on what I do with it, I can get the different answers, all the standard wonderful quantum stuff. Forget about that. Okay. Let's say there's just an uncertainty that I don't know what state I've been handed. Okay? So let's say there's just some standard classical uncertainty in what state I've been given. With some probability p1, I have state psi1. Probability p2, I have state psi2, and so on. Okay? In that situation, it's very convenient to talk about a density matrix. So if with some probabilities pi, I've been given state psi I, then rho is the sum over those I, those classical probabilities, pi, psi I, psi I. Okay? So if you like, if these states were all orthogonal to each other, then this would be something that has P1, P2, P3 down the diagonals of the matrix. But in general, this is what it is. Okay? And this is just baking in that, for example, if I compute any expectation value of O will just be the weighted sum of pi times O evaluated in that state. Okay? Just a very convenient way of talking about that classical uncertainty. Now, in this language, let's do a simple example. Okay, let's say I have a spin a half system, so it's 1 over root 2 up plus down. Okay? The density matrix for this state would be 1 half, 1 half, 1 half, 1 half. Okay? It has 1 halves in the off-diagonal guys as well. This is very different than a density matrix, which if I just handed you the state spin up with probability 50% and the state spin down with probability 50%, I just didn't know which state I was given. Okay? Someone flipped a coin and decided to give me one state or the other. That density matrix would be 1 half, 1 half, 0, 0. Okay? So it's the presence of these off-diagonal terms is associated with the state being pure. These things where where the off-diagonal entries are zero, and you have a bunch of numbers smaller than one on the diagonal, reflect some actual classical uncertainty in the state that you're given in this language. So there's really an invariance difference. If someone hands you a density matrix, you can decide, you can actually just check if the state is pure or not. How could you check if it's pure? Well, if it's pure, rho squared is equal to rho, for example. Okay. If it's pure, it means in some basis, even if you're not smart enough to write on the right basis, in some basis it's 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, so rho squared is equal to rho. That's a very simple check you can do. So you can see that this satisfies rho squared equals rho. That definitely does not. Okay. We'll talk about better measures in a second for that reflect this, but that's just a simple one. Yes?
In the expression for the density matrix, do the states have to be orthogonal?
No. Just someone hands you a bunch of states, and then you just put them together. Right. They don't have to be orthogonal. Okay, so just using this language, let's go back and rephrase the standard textbook way of talking about a measurement. Okay, so the standard textbook way, what we just said colloquially a second ago, which is that if you do the experiment with this probability, you get the outcome. Then if you see that outcome, start evolving again with that Schrodinger equation. Right? Let's just say this again, but say it in this language. I just want to say the standard textbook thing in this language. Okay. So first of all, what is just the evolution of the, how does the Schrodinger, the Schrodinger equation for the density matrix is IH bar d rho by dt is the commutator of H with rho. Okay. Just like any Schrodinger equation for operators. Okay. So if I hand you a density matrix, it's just evolving unitarily in time, merrily along. Okay, and it does that. We're just talking about the textbook statement. Now the textbook statement comes along and says, now let's say you make a measurement of the operator O. Okay? So let's say this started off as a pure state psi. So it's evolving in time. Rho is psi psi, it's evolving in time, right? Now let's say you measure the operator O. So psi is some sum over eigenstates of O, whatever I was calling them before. Phi, let me call them n cn. Okay, these are eigenstates of whatever your these are eigenstates of whatever you're measuring. Okay. So before the measurement, rho is some matrix, which if I work in this basis, would have these diagonal terms, C1 mod squared, C capital N mod squared, if it's an N by N system, but it would also have all sorts of off-diagonal terms, C1 star C2, C1 star CN, and so on, okay? CN star C1, and so on, right? So rho is this nice big density matrix with all these off-diagonal components. So the standards say evolve in time until you make the measurement. At the time of measurement, let's say psi looks, expands psi out, so it looks like that. Right after the measurement, we have a new density matrix. So this is before measurement, and then something horrible and discontinuous happens, and then right after the measurement, I have rho nu, which is equal to C1 mod squared up to Cn mod squared, and then just zero everywhere else. So that's the normal way we talk about it, right? We say after the measurement with probability C1 mod squared is in state 1, probability C2 mod squared in state 2, and so on. And then after the measurement, it's in one of those states, depending on which outcome you saw. And then as you continue to evolve, well, You have to, now what you have isn't a pure state. Now you just have, with some probability, you've got one outcome or another or another, and now you're going to keep evolving. Okay? But you have to start with this new density matrix. So this is the density matrix of the system, unitarily evolving, everything is fine, and then some measurement operation happens. Okay? And then right after the measurement, poof, it's this new density matrix where I deleted all of the off-diagonal components. Now it can keep evolving in time with this new thing using the Schrodinger equation until I do another measurement. Then the same thing happens, right? Every time I hit a measurement, I write rho in the basis of the thing that I'm measuring. Then I delete all the off-diagonal components and I keep going. Right? So this is the standard way of describing the measurement process. Is that clear? Now, and this is exactly what we're saying was so unsatisfying, right? It's very weird to have two different laws of nature, one for just evolving along and one for when someone deigns to do a measurement. Okay? What we've just seen is that this is actually unnecessary. It's fundamentally unnecessary. What's going on is that there's a very big pure state, a very big pure state that involves both the system and the apparatus. That very big pure state is evolving purely unitarily all the time. Okay? Nothing funny going on. It's evolving purely unitarily all the time. But if you insist on just keeping track of what the system is doing, then there's an effective density matrix that describes just the system. And that effective density matrix will do this automatically. You don't have to put it as a new principle of nature. It just does it automatically as a consequence of the nature of the interaction. So let's formalize that idea a little bit more. So if I have a big Hilbert space that consists of a system and an apparatus, then it can have a pure density matrix for the whole thing, but it makes sense to talk about what you might call the reduced density matrix for the system S. The reduced density matrix for the system S is the trace over just the apparatus of the whole rho. Okay. Yes?
So this basically means that all those interpretations of quantum mechanics, like collapse of the wave function in any world and stuff like that, it's basically useless.
Well, sorry. The collapse of the wave function is not just useless, it's sort of physically wrong. And this tells you the sort of correct way of thinking about it. It even tells you there are situations where you might be able to mess with it. Okay? There are situations where you might be able to measure things in such a way that you don't disturb things so much, and then more interesting things can happen. Okay, so now, of course, effectively, in most cases, what we've just done is explain what where the apparent collapse of the wave function is coming from, as really a consequence of deciding to look at a subpart of the system. Okay, and we're just about to formalize that a little bit more. I want to stress that this is not an interpretational question. This is really the measurement is a physical process. Okay, I'm not saying there aren't mysteries associated with quantum mechanics. There are, but it's very important to know where the mysteries are and where they're not, so you're not constantly fooling yourself, chasing around things that are actually sort of either trivial or understood for a long time. Okay. Nothing mysterious is happening when a grubby experimentalist, I can say this because you're all theorists, is sitting down there in their basement, measuring some spin. No magic, mystic thing is going on involving their consciousness, which is sometimes limited, right? So nothing like that is happening, right? That's a purely beautiful physical process. You can try to actually, like I said, you can try to model it. You can try to do experiments with it. You can measure how fast it happens. You can do a lot of things with it. It's a physical process. Okay? Where the mysteries with quantum mechanics ultimately are, I believe, nowhere to be found in screwing around with non-relativistic systems and playing around with basic things with Hilbert spaces and stuff like that. There's nothing there. That's all, I think, perfectly understood. There are ultimately questions which we'll come to. The really deep questions having to do with quantum mechanics and gravity. Really, the deepest questions that seem to go to the heart of the quantum part of the problem have to do with cosmology, which I'll talk about probably on the last day. In other words, every time you can make a useful separation between the system and the apparatus, every time you can step outside and look at what you're talking about from an outside vantage point, there's nothing wrong with quantum mechanics. Okay? Everything is perfectly sensible. There's no interpretational problems. Some people disagree, but I think they're drastically wrong. There's no difficulties. Where the difficulties ultimately happen is in something like cosmology. In cosmology, you can't step outside the universe. Okay? There's one big system, and it's not clear how to talk about quantum mechanics when you have a completely closed system. When you can make a separation between system and environment, and the environment is big, even in some limit where you can mentally imagine making the environment infinitely big, then there's zero difficulties. But all the interesting difficulties start with cosmology, when we can't step outside the universe. So making sense of words like the wave function of the universe is an interesting question. Actually, even the wave function of the universe is a sensible concept in certain situations. If the universe kept expanding out forever, got bigger and bigger, got infinitely big, eventually the notion of a wave function of the universe actually makes sense. We'll talk about it. But it gets very confusing in a situation like the universe we have today, which is accelerating, which limits the number of measurements we can make, makes it impossible to completely step outside, makes it impossible to do the things that allow us to extract sharp predictions from perfectly sharp predictions from quantum mechanics. So there are mysteries, but there are, I think, nowhere to be found screwing around with little Hilbert spaces, spin a half systems, experiments. That's, I think, just perfectly understood. Okay. Yes?
So you've got your quantum system, and then you've got your measurement device that's macroscopic,
yeah,
machine. Now you put the whole lot inside a big box, then the machine is going to observe this system, and it's going to do this thing that we usually call like wave function collapse in it, but we don't know what's going on. Then, like, it's as collapsed as it's going to get according to this argument, because the whole macroscopic thing. So when we observe it, it's not going to make any other change to it.
Then there's a correlation between what you see in your head. Okay, so we have to now apply quantum mechanics to the whole system, including the state of our brain, correlated with the fact that we see that it was flashing up, correlated with the whole thing.
Right, but the measurement device inside the box is macroscopic. So
yeah.
Like, your argument as to why this thing effectively goes to zero still applies.
That's right.
So it's already done that, so observing it doesn't really make any more change.
Right. So that's a very simple situation because you look at what's going on and you think, with some classical uncertainty, alpha mod squared the state is this, beta mod squared is that. Putting extra stuff on top of it isn't going to change that. As long as we're talking about observables associated with the system. You see, you if you really want to put us in. And then you also have to say that if the spin is up or is flashing up, then something also tells us that it's up. And simultaneously, if it's down. Okay. But then if you just keep applying this logic to bigger and bigger systems, you never get the wrong answer. And also, it sort of explains how it's happening in a little more detail. So this part of the discussion, I mean, there are many. So when I say there's no interpretational issues, there are many questions you can ask, and they all have outstanding answers. Okay, and I'd be happy to talk about. Let me mention one example. Right. So you might say, why, if this is the picture, why do we feel that after the experiment happened, one thing happened? Right. Why don't we feel like we're in this strange superposition of all possible states? Why do we feel certain of the outcome of any given experiment? That's one of the standard bugaboos of the people who care a lot about these interpretational questions. And that question has a very good answer, okay? Along exactly the same lines. But once again, you have to put us, You have to find a quantum mechanical question. You have to phrase the question more precisely in quantum mechanical terms, and you find, and it has an extremely straightforward answer. But I'd be happy to describe in a little more detail later. Actually, let me give you something to think about, which is very related to these questions. By the way, when I say that these things were sorted out a long time ago, well, Bohr expressed himself very, very, very poorly. But Bohr basically understood the points that I'm telling you. Certainly, other people in the 30s and 40s understood these points very well. And then they were understood again after people decided to get very confused about quantum mechanics for no reason. They got understood again very beautifully by people like Zurek and his friends in the starting in the early 80s, who said it more precisely, more formally. But just to give you a simple version of exactly the same sort of question that I want you to chew over. Imagine you have some unstable atomic excitation, okay? in fact, this thing came out when people were studying tracks that particles left in cloud chambers when they were trying to when they're looking at cosmic rays and things like that. So imagine the following situation: you have a cloud chamber. So there's a bunch of the way it works is that there's a bunch of water vapor, and then if an electron comes zipping out, it ionizes a lot of things in its path, so you see a track. Okay. So imagine you have some atomic state which is in some excited state. Let's say it's an S wave excited state, the first excited state, but it's an S wave. Okay, so the particle decays, an electron is, something is spit out, an electron is spit out, let's say. Okay, now, every experiment where this is done, what do you see? You see a straight line going out, right? Electron is zipping out in a straight line. In any given single experiment, when one of the, it's not a statistical thing, right? When one of them decays, what you actually see is things going out in a dead straight line, ionizing things in a straight line in their path. The thing is an S wave. The S wave has the equal probability to be emitted in all angles. So how is it possible that we get something that looks like it's coming out in a straight line? Why don't we see that it's coming out in some mush like that? Okay. So think about that. Think about that along the lines that I'm explaining to you. That has a very simple and nice explanation. But if you understand that question, you'll understand all of the questions of the variety that you're asking as well. Okay, but that's actually a simpler and sharper version where you don't worry so much about the way our brain works. But the answer is identical in both cases. All right, so let's keep going with this formalism for a little bit. Why do we do this? It's because if I'm really interested in the expectation value of a system observable.
Can you just clarify again what is rho red S?
Oh, sorry. So this is called the reduced density matrix. I'm just defining it. Okay. It's associated with just the system variables, and it's what you get by taking the full density matrix, which corresponds to a pure state here, and just tracing over the apparatus. Now, why do we care about this quantity? We care about this quantity because, just for the reasons that we've been going through. If I'm interested in an expectation value of a system observable, it's equal to trace over everything, system and apparatus, of rho times OS. But if O only depends on system operators, I can do the trace over the apparatus. So this is the trace over just S of rho reduced S times OS. Just by the definition. So I do the trace of the apparatus first. The resulting object lives in the system Hilbert space. And so that's the so-called reduced density matrix. Yes?
OK, just one thing. What if one could devise an extremely small measuring apparatus?
Then it wouldn't measure it. That's the cool thing about this whole picture, right? It tells you actually detailed things. It tells you that sufficiently small measuring apparatus don't do a very good job measuring things. If you had a, if you had a measuring apparatus that was made out of 10 little atoms, then it won't do very much. Now, of course, because your brain is macroscopic, you also wouldn't know that it's doing very much. You see, for you to know what it's doing, you ultimately need something that amplifies that in your head. Right? You see something, so ultimately correlated with the little apparatus you built is something which would make you convinced that it made a measurement. So ultimately, there is a big part here somewhere, because you're big. Okay? But it tells you something. I mean, it tells you that if it made any sense at all to talk about also creatures that were made out of 20 atoms and doing apparatuses made with 3 atoms, then the whole thing, everything would be incredibly quantum mechanical. This whole idea of this approximate collapse of the wave function is crucially tied to the distinction between small and big, macroscopic apparatuses, macroscopic environment, and so on. Okay? That's a critical part of it. In other words, this is also a very, very important. This means that it's part of. Let me just finish talking about this, and I'll make some general comments. It's going to take five more minutes. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a quick that. Yeah. So is it actually like the number of particles that's important, or if you could say couple it to some kind of superfluid where you've got a lot of particles?
No, that's right. It's not simply the number of particles. It's whether the interactions are such that different things in the system become macroscopically different in the apparatus, whatever it is. It's just right. So in fact, I mean, there's classes of experiments that people do. Things that are called quantum non-demolition experiments, for example. Where that's the point. You try to organize the interaction so that, in fact, doesn't cause different guys to make macroscopically different footprints, and then you study what happens. Or people did experiments also in the 90s where they took Rydberg atoms, right? So they took the very excited states of atoms which were orbiting basically semi-classically, like little planets going around the atom. That's a quite classical, like, big state. And it was very cold and so on. And then they would just heat it a little bit. They'd, like, expose it to microwaves and see, poof, it would all disappear. And you'd lose that coherence and decohere things quickly. So there's really some power in this way of thinking about things. It tells you that it's not just measure, don't measure, you measure, your dog doesn't measure, right? It's a detailed physical thing about what the interaction is between the system and the apparatus. But the big picture is that getting outcomes, predictions out of quantum mechanics, okay? The standard predictions we talk about out of quantum mechanics are done in a limit. To get perfectly precise predictions out of quantum mechanics, when we say, don't worry about it, yes, things are probabilistic, but it's okay, we predict the probabilities exactly, and so on, right? We pat ourselves on the head, and we tell ourselves not to worry so much about the fact that we can't, the world isn't deterministic. This is in a limit. And it's interesting, because it necessarily invokes the presence of very large apparatus, environment, whatever, okay? To make precise, the predictions we make from quantum mechanics are truly precise in a limit. A limit where we do the experiment infinitely many times, and a limit where we use an infinitely large apparatus compared, an infinitely large apparatus if you want it to be perfectly, perfectly precise. Okay? Only in that situation, infinitely repetition of experiments and infinitely large apparatus, do we actually get precise predictions out of quantum mechanics. And that's the whole logical apparatus of quantum mechanics is not decoupled from forces on us, this distinction between system and some infinitely large rest of the universe. Okay, that's why it gets confusing in cosmology. But until you get to cosmology and gravity, everything is fine. This very basic fact we're going to come to again and again, that this very basic fact is a more precise way of understanding why space-time is doomed. We'll come back to that. We'll come back to that also on Friday. Okay? But that's a very, very important feature of the way we have to think about quantum mechanics. Anyway, this reduced density matrix then has the property that if it's this reduced density matrix that rapidly evolves from its nice form with all these off-diagonal things to the form after the experiment happened where all the off-diagonal guys went to zero and you just have guys on the diagonal. Okay? But that's perfectly compatible with the underlying unitary evolution of the entire big density matrix. Okay? Now, all of the words that I said go through verbatim for the question of why the world looks classical. Except here we actually have a few more interesting, a few more physical things to talk about. So let's go back and ask the question again. Why is it that we don't, when we walk in the room, we don't see the chair in the superposition here and there? Why don't we see it in one of these crazy 1 over root 2 here plus there states? The reason is that long before we walked into the room, it was interacting with the air molecules in the room. Okay. So even if it's, for some crazy reason, at some initial time, it was in that weird superposition, then a tiny amount of time later, when the chair is there, the air molecules bounce off of it here. So some of them are bounce off of it here and move in that direction. When it's over there, they bounce off of it and move in a different direction. Okay? It doesn't take very, there's 10 to the 30 air molecules in the room. It doesn't take that much difference for any one of the states in order now for the footprints of the chair there and the chair there to be in the air molecule Hilbert space to become macroscopically different for that overlap to go to zero. Okay. So it's just because it's interacting with a big environment, again, that we don't see that quantum coherence. Okay. We don't see it. So this whole phenomenon is called decoherence for obvious reasons. You have a density matrix corresponding to a pure state, which can rapidly evolve to one that looks like a mixed state. And as a consequence of the interaction of a smaller system with a macroscopically big environment. Okay? Yes?
Yeah, so why does it always stay in that place? Like, you have 1 over root 2, let's say, you know.
Yes.
Position A plus position
right.
B.
That's right.
And then your outcome after the measurement by the air molecules is, one half.
That's right. So that simply reflects the fact that before I walked into the room, I actually didn't know where the chair was. So maybe with a 50% chance it was there, with a 50% chance it was there. That's the classical uncertainty. Okay, it's not. You see the difference between these states. It's like for the spin a half system. It's very different to say it's 1 over root 2 up plus down versus with 50% probability it's up and with 50% probability it's down. For example, there's a big difference between those two states. If I measure the spin in the x direction, when it's 1 over root 2 up plus 1 over root 2 down, all the time I will measure the spin in the x direction is 1, right? Because that state is secretly the spin in the x direction. Whereas if it's a half up plus a half down, well, half of the time it'll be up and half of the time it'll be down. Those are not the same physical situation, despite the fact that when I measure the probabilities for just up and down, they're the same. But one of them is a pure state, one of them is a mixed state. Okay. So similarly here, there are weird measurements that I could do which would be probing whether the chair was simultaneously here and there. Okay. If it was in that weird superposition, I would find that, yes, it is simultaneously here and there. But when I say with 50% probability is there and 50% probability is there, it means that every possible interaction with the chair is like it's either there or it's there. In no sense is it this entangled sum of both of them. Just a literal analog of that spin half system that we just talked about. Okay, but we actually learned something slightly deeper here as well. So one of the features we know is that the classical-like things in the world are approximately sort of position and momentum eigenstates. Okay. So why is that? Again, it isn't because you take a classical world and you quantize it. It's the other way around. The world is quantum mechanical. In fact, it's the structure of the interaction Hamiltonian that tells you. It's really the other way around. Once you realize that the emergence of classical behavior, the lack of coherence, has to do with the interaction of a system with an environment, Then it's quantum mechanics that tells you what are the states that are going to look classical-like. The states that are going to look classical-like are the states which will evolve in time, roughly keeping this factorized form. So if I give you the chair here and air molecules, this state, as time goes on, will roughly stay chair here and some correlated air molecules. Okay? So it'll stay, the whole state will evolve in this approximately factorized way. Okay? So in other words, if I just input that state, localized chair here, and I look at its reduced density matrix, it's not going to be changing very much with time. Okay? It's the state that looks like chair here plus chair there. That one does not evolve in time in a way that looks like it keeps a roughly factorized form, right? It starts off with chair here, 1/2 chair here plus chair there, and it's the air molecules where they are, and it evolves into 1/2 chair here plus air molecules associated with here, plus chair there and air molecules associated with there. Now, that's not roughly a system state tensored an environment state anymore at all. Okay, so that's why that thing decoheres like mad. But the things that don't decohere are the things which are just like the chair sitting here. Okay? Why is that ultimately? So in other words, it's the structure of the interaction Hamiltonian that tells you what states will be classical-like. You don't have to guess ahead of time. You can actually ask, you can hunt around. You can ask what states will have the property that they evolve in time approximately keeping this factorized form. Depending on what the interaction is, it's quantum mechanics that tells you. It's what things even have a chance of becoming classical-like. But the reason why it's these things, the reason why it's approximate position eigenstates, is because of a deep fact about nature. Interactions are local in space. So things are classical physics, classical-like states are localized, spatially localized, because the interactions in nature are local in space. It's because the air molecules have to interact with the chair by bumping into the chair here. Okay? So it's the locality of interactions that ultimately guarantees that the things that look classical-like have roughly well-defined position, momenta, and so on. Okay? All right. Now, this is all part of a more general story, just slightly more general story. Well, it's really exactly the same story. But let's say in general we have two Hilbert spaces, A and B. Okay. And I have some state. I have some state psi that lives in the product of these two Hilbert spaces. So I can talk about a big rho, which is psi psi. Actually, before we talk about the rho, let's just say some standard words. If I have a state which is like something in A tensored with something in B, okay? A state like that, that's a nice pure state, but it's natural to call that an unentangled state. Okay? There's A tensored with B. But if I have a state which is alpha 1 A1 B1 plus alpha 2 A2 B2, then it's natural to call that an entangled state. The different pieces, in no sense does a state factorize into something that lives in one space and something that lives in the other. There's correlations between what's going on in one space and what's going on in the other. Okay? Of course, generic states in quantum mechanics are entangled. So this would be called an entangled state. Now suppose that you are just made out of A. You have access to operators for A. You can make measurements on A. How can you decide whether you're entangled with something else or not. How do you know? Well, I mean, you can do lots and lots of measurements and determine what the density matrix just for A is, right? Just by doing measurements on A, you can figure out what the density matrix on A is. Similarly for B. So it makes sense to define this notion, rho A, just like what we talked before. This is the reduced density matrix, but in this case, just tracing over B of the full row. And row B is tracing over A of the full row. Okay? So row A and row B are what observers making measurements, row A and row B is what observers making measurements on A or on B would see. Now, there's a very nice quantity that you can talk about anytime you have any sort of density matrix. Okay? If you have any sort of density matrix, remember, the density matrix says that with probability pi, you're in some state psi I. So there is a natural notion which we normally call entropy, which is just the sum over I of negative pi log pi. Okay. So that's a standard definition of entropy. But I don't know if you guys feel the same way about the entropy. But I was very happy to learn this quote by Johnny von Neumann, who, when I think it was one of these people, who was maybe Shannon, who was talking about information theory very, very early on. And introduced his notion of entropy. Well, he didn't know what to call it, and he was talking to von Neumann, and von Neumann told him, call it entropy. It's a word like many, many physicists use. Nobody knows what it means, and it sounds impressive. So I'm going to avoid that. We'll use the word entropy, but I just mean, this is just a definition of what it is. It's that for me. Okay? Sum of negative log P. All right. And in general, if someone hands you a density matrix rho, we can say there's an entropy associated with density matrix rho, which we can now write quantum mechanically as negative trace rho log rho. Okay? That's just exactly the same thing. Rho is diagonal in some basis, and we can just add them all up. Okay? So sum of negative pi log pi. Now, this entropy has a nice feature. First of all, what is the entropy of a pure state? It's zero, right? Because in a pure state, there's just one, right. So the pure state, the entropy is obviously zero. All right. Now, let's say you have an n by n. Let's say you have an n-dimensional Hilbert space. Okay, if you have an n-dimensional Hilbert space, then let's say your density matrix is maximally confused. Okay, so you have no idea which state you're in. So roughly speaking, the most confused state you could possibly have is when rho is diagonal and is 1 over n on all of the entries. Right, 1 over n, 1 over n, 1 over n. If it's an n by n matrix, it's just 1 over n down the diagonal. In that case, what is the density matrix? Or what is the entanglement entropy? What is this entropy? Well, it's just 1 over n times log n multiplied by n. So it's just log n. Okay? So when you have a pure state, the density, this entropy is 0. The incredibly confused state, the density matrix, the entropy is log n, where n is the dimensionality of your Hilbert space. Okay? Now, it's a very, very simple little exercise that uses the fact that the function x log x is concave to prove that actually that log n is the maximum possible value for the entropy associated with an n by n matrix. Okay? So this S is actually bounded always. It's less than or equal to log of the dimensionality of the Hilbert space and greater than or equal to 0. Okay, so this is a pure state. This is maximally mixed. Okay, so these are things you can define for any density matrix. Now let's go back and talk about these rho A and rho B that happen when you have a system broken into two parts. Okay? Well, there's a density that you can associate it with SA and one that you can associate with SB. Okay? Very nice exercise is to prove that these are always equal to each other. SA is actually equal to SB. Because they're equal, they're actually a property of the joint. You can, not one or the other, it's a property of both of them. Okay. So exercise is to prove that. It's a very, very simple proof. So if you're working too hard, it's simpler than what you're trying. Okay. So this is very cool, because one way you can decide whether or not you're entangled, let's say there's A and B. You're on one side, B's on the other side. Just by doing measurements on your side, A, you can first of all decide whether you're entangled or not. Okay? For example, if SA is 0, then you're not entangled. Okay, so that's fairly clear. Now, something a little more interesting is the fact that actually, let's say you do a measurement and you find out, you find out some S. That actually tells you something about how big one or the other Hilbert space can be, right? So if you find on your side that your S is bigger than something, then first of all, you know you're entangled with something else. Secondly, you know that something else has a certain minimum number of degrees of freedom. The Hilbert space on the other side is minimally so big, right? Because that entangled entropy is less than or equal to the log of the dimensionality of the Hilbert space of A and of the dimensionality of the Hilbert space of B. Okay? So you can also have some idea of what it is that you're entangled with by making a measurement of your density matrix. So this is a more general notion, and what we had been talking about up to now was the special case where A was gigantic compared to B. Okay? In the case where A is gigantic compared to B, depending on what A and B, well, depending on whether we're talking about measurement or about the or the emergence of classical physics, we have the discussion that we're having. But more generally, when we split things up into different subsystems, we have this general notion of entanglement and this general notion of entanglement entropy. So that SAB is called entanglement entropy. Let me give a final quick, again, these are all basically the same phenomenon. Let's say we collide a whole bunch of particles together. They smash into each other, huge amount of energy, big mashup. And a big fireball of stuff comes out. Okay. So let's say there's a bomb sitting there. I aim some laser beams at it. I detonate it. Poof! All sorts of stuff comes out. Okay. So a huge number of particles are coming out. Let's say I'm measuring a lot of the light which is coming out. Okay. Now, you think that what's coming out looks sort of approximately thermal. It's a big fireball of stuff coming out. It's certainly approximately thermal. And yet, what I threw in was everything was a pure state, right? I mean, I threw in some particular laser beams, two photons coming in, they bang into this bomb, they trigger something, but it's all a pure state. Okay? So how come it is that I started with a pure state, but what comes out looks like this total crazy fireball? It looks thermal. Really, it's a pure state again. Right? Really, it is a pure state. But the reason it can look thermal is because we're not measuring every single property of every single particle coming out. Okay? So this is actually a very simple generic feature when you have a big Hilbert space. When you have a big Hilbert space, let's say you have a big Hilbert space, and you have a generic state in a big Hilbert space. Okay? But it is a generic state. Now, let's say that you're looking at a subspace of that big Hilbert space. Okay? If you look at a subspace of that big Hilbert space, a generic state, well, so if it's a subspace, I should talk about its reduced density matrix, I should talk about its entanglement entropy, and so on. Okay? What you'll find is that if the subspace is small compared to the whole Hilbert space, a generic state will look just dead, completely, maximally mixed. Okay? Only when you start looking, if the dimensionality of the Hilbert space is of order e to the n, only when you start looking at e to the n over 2, roughly speaking, that size Hilbert space, you actually start seeing that it's a pure state. In other words, you've got to make measurements on essentially every single thing in order to see that the underlying state was pure. I'm running out of time, so let me actually just give you a little exercise to do. Let's model things by having n spins. Okay? So let's say I have a Hilbert space where I have n spins, and let's talk about two different states. Here's one of them. Okay? One state is the sum of these guys with, I don't know, what's 1 over root 2 to the n, I guess. Okay? But let's say I sum over all possible states, sigma 1 up to sigma n. This is a nice pure state. Okay? This is a nice pure state. And actually, you can look at reduced density matrices here, and everything looks... And this is the analog of our very coherent states that we had talked about before. Okay? But actually, if you do something slightly more generic and put a phase here, e to the I 5 sigma 1 up to sigma n, so I'm just summing over all the sigmas to be plus minus a half. Okay? And let's say you just put some random phase there. Just imagine the phis depend randomly. If you now take this state, this is a nice sort of generic example of some random state in this large Hilbert space. You will find that if you look at less than n halves of the spins, you'll find that the entanglement entropy is whatever the size that you're looking at. If you're looking at m of them, you'll find the entanglement entropy is approximately m. Okay? So it looks completely dead thermal. This is why things look thermal in nature so much, right? The thermality is a reflection of the entanglement of the things that you're looking at with the things that you're not looking at. And if the things you're not looking at, there's way more of them than things that you are looking at, typically, a typical state is going to look just completely mixed. But this tells you something a little more detailed, as you can work through this example. Once you start making, once the size of A and B start becoming comparable, you're splitting them up into two pieces. Once it's roughly n halves and n halves, then the entanglement entropy starts inching back down. You start looking at two-thirds of the spins, three-quarters of the spins, okay? Ultimately, if you look at every single spin, you'll see a pure state. You'll see that rho is just, that trace rho log rho is zero. If you look at n minus one of the spins, it'll be damn close to zero. But you look at n halves of the spins, even already at n halves of the spins is when it first starts turning around. Even already at n halves, it looks incredibly, amazingly thermal. Okay. So it tells you this is why things look so thermal all the time. Okay. It's once again this phenomenon, an underlying pure state. It's all of these things are really a phenomenon of the fact that it's incredibly easy for states in large Hilbert spaces to become exponentially small overlap with each other. Okay, so that basic fact over and over again explains many different things, and here it also explains why typical states in large Hilbert spaces look basically maximally mixed. It also tells you that if you're trying to tease out whether a state is or isn't pure, you have to work damn hard. Okay? You have to make sure you're making measurements on basically all the particle, everything there is, in order to be able to make that decision. All right? And anyway, so this is all the things that I want to say about basic kinematic things about quantum mechanics. And when we come back, we'll go back and get down to the business of putting quantum mechanics and relativity together.